Big news! Wayfair's Black Friday sale is here. Right now, score up to 80% off everything home. These are our best deals of the year. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday sale now at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
When I was a very, very small kid, actually, I wasn't good at math or physics. My dream was to become an investigative journalist.
Really?
Yes, yeah, yes.
Hello and welcome to the James Allen on F1 podcast brought to you by Autosport. Now this week, we have the latest in our series of F1 team principal interviews as we meet Eyo Komatsu at the HQ of Haas, F1's smallest team. What Haas may lack in headcount, though, they more than make up for in team spirit, as this engaging interview will reveal. Now, Eyo has been at Haas since the team began in Formula 1 in 2016. Last season, Gene Haas picked him to succeed the charismatic but sweary Gunther Steiner as team principal. Eyo was born in Japan and moved to England as a teenager to study English and pursue his dream of working in Formula 1. He rose up through the ranks as an engineer with Lotus and Renault, where he worked closely with Romain Grosjean. As a highly competitive F1 season comes to a close, Haas finds itself fighting with Aston Martin and Racing Bulls for sixth in the Constructors' Championship. Eyo reflects on some of these decisions taken earlier in the season, which have boosted Haas's recent competitiveness. Well, joining me in the studio for a wraparound chat on this interview is former Red Bull head of aero and Aston Martin F1 technical director, Dan Fallows. Hi, Dan, how are things?
Very good, thank you. Thank you for having me back on again. So, very interesting chat, I think.
Always good to see you, Dan. Always good. Now, listen, you've worked for big, well-resourced F1 teams competing against Haas. Set the tone for us. How tough is it for a small, independent team like that to take on the established names in F1?
It is incredibly difficult. I mean, I think it's sort of well understood that to compete right at the front of the F1 grid these days, you have to have, you know, not only sort of great people, but you have to be able to have all the tools and, you know, simulation tools and facilities, wind tunnels and so on to compete. You know, they have to be absolutely top notch, and that's incredibly important. You know, for a small team that's maybe struggled with budget in the past, they're just not going to have the same level, of these sort of tools. And I think that does, it creates a number of problems. But equally, on the other hand, yeah, there is a sense of, you know, when you're in a smaller team that doesn't have that, there is this sort of spirit of the underdog. And I think that does sort of motivate people in strange ways. And it's actually it's quite nice working for a team like that as well. But it's different when your expectations aren't that you're going to be winning races. You know, sometimes I think with the bigger teams, there's a feeling that you're going to, you know, if you don't win, it's a failure. Whereas something like that, you basically just want to make a good account for yourself. And so it's a very different prospect, certainly.
Certainly is. Well, let's get straight to our team principal interview then. I went up to Banbury, near Oxford, to the headquarters of the Haas F1 team to meet Eyo Komatsu, the team principal. I hope you enjoy the chat. Eyo, it's such a pleasure to see you, and thank you very much for inviting me here to the Haas headquarters just outside Banbury. You're having a pretty good season so far, particularly the last few months, aren't you?
Yeah, thank you very much for having me on this show. But yeah, last couple of races, it's been fantastic. This season started with a big challenge in Melbourne, but how we reacted from that point to have such a competitive car now, I'm very, very proud of the team.
Before we started recording, you were just telling me a little bit about your kind of origin story and how you came to the UK as a young man, as a teenager, really.
Yes.
Because you wanted to be in Formula One, and you've been here, what, over 30 years?
Yes. Yeah. When I was a very, very small kid, actually, I wasn't good at maths or physics. My dream was to become an investigative journalist.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. So I had no interest in science, actually. But then as a kid, back in Japan in the late 80s, everybody was interested in motorbikes. I started riding motorbikes and then naturally started watching MotoGP. Then Formula One was very popular, so I just bumped into Formula One on TV. And then because I always wanted to do something international, then something hard, and then just the Formula One really resonated with me straight away. Then I was 14, I just decided this is what I wanted to do.
Wow, that's commitment, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, but then like when you're 14, when you bump into something you love, then completely resonated to your heart, you don't think about commitment. You think, wow, this is what I want to do. Okay, the next thing is like, okay, to do Formula One, what do I need to do? What's my first step? Then even now, you know, back then, most of the teams are based in UK. Then everybody needs to speak English. So I was like, okay, after high school, I'm going to go to UK, learn English, go to university there, then make contact, maybe trying to get placement. Then hopefully I can have a chance to work in Formula One.
And you've risen up to the level of a Formula One team principal. Did you ever imagine in your wildest dreams when you were a teenager coming over here that you would get to that level?
No. All I wanted to do was looking at those cars. I thought, wow, you know, I want to be part of making that car. And then between motorbike and car, because I was riding motorbikes, I thought about it. But then I thought, without knowing anything about engineering, I thought if I was going to be an engineer, I can influence more in the car racing, the motorbike racing. You know, without knowing anything, you can look at riders, how they use their bodies. And you can see that how much of the, let's say, proportion of the performance coming from rider. So I thought as an engineer, I can make more difference in cars. That's why I chose Formula One.
You're one of the new cohort, really, of team principals who've come up from being engineers as a background. When I started in Formula One, they were all kind of entrepreneurial sort of figures like Frank Williams,
yes,
or Ron Dennis and those, Flavio Briatore, those kind of people.
Yeah.
Business people, yes, but perhaps mechanics, perhaps people who'd work somehow in racing. But now we've got you, we've got Andrea Stella, who's obviously doing a fantastic job,
yep,
at McLaren. You've got James Vowles, again, doing good stuff at Williams, Laurent Mekies at Red Bull Racing, Andy Cowell at Aston Martin. Fred Vasseur is an engineer by training. Alain Permain, another one. I mean, the list goes on.
Yeah.
I think something like 7 out of 10,
wow,
now, yeah, are engineers. So how do you explain that phenomenon?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, clearly it's a trend, but I'm not sure if there's one type fits for all, if you like. You know, I think even looking at now 10 teams, the environment at 10 teams are very, very different. Each team has got their strengths and weakness, and then what's required as a leader for those 10 teams, I suspect it's very different. So I'm not sure, you know, you need to be an engineer in the modern days of Formula One to be a team principal. I think, you know, you got to fundamentally create a performing organization. So not just engineering, you got to understand people, you got to be able to communicate very well. So there's, I think, various skill sets required. And then, like you said, at the moment, it happened to be 7 out of 10 people are ex-engineers, but not sure if that's what's required. You know, it does help in the sense that because I came through the engineering ranks, I have certain understanding of the cars. So when I talk to my technical department, you know, making certain decisions, I can understand what they're talking about, which is important. But at the same time, you know, let's say I'm less exposed to the business side before, so that I need more help from my other guys. But then again, in the team, it's never, these days, modern F1, it's so complicated. It's never one person show. You know, you got to really get a team of people working together, give them clear direction and objectives, and they are the one actually delivering. You know, I'm not the one deciding the aero development directions. I listen to them, and then if they require my input, of course I give it to them, but I'm never going to tell them how to develop the car. It's not my job. It's not my expertise. They know, they do that day in, day out. So they know what they're doing. So I feel like my job is really to listen to those experts and then let them tell me what they need from me, what I need to provide. So I feel like I'm like a facilitator, shall I say.
But you're also a decision maker.
And, yes.
You know, obviously you've come from a background of being a top Formula One engineer. You worked a lot with Romain Grosjean, for example. In fact, I think you came across to here with Grosjean, right?
Yes.
You both worked together at the Enstone-based team, which is now called Alpine, but was then called Renault. And so when you get the nod from the big man to say, Ayo, we'd like you to step up now and be a team principal. You mentioned there that you're on very solid ground when it comes to the engineering. It means no engineer is going to blame. You can't blame each other because you can see right through anybody. So that cuts out a blame culture straight away, doesn't it? Which is helpful.
Sure.
But then again, you've got some big gaps in terms of the commercial side, in terms of dealing with the FIA, the politics. So have you been sort of set up for success in order to, in other words, having the responsibilities that match your skill set?
It's an interesting question. I don't think there's a simple answer because every job I've done, let's say when I was a performance or when I was a tire engineer, then because there was a tire wall, right, I was completely focused on tires to put as much performance as possible on the car. But then once that finishes, you know, you're looking at overall performance of the car, what you can contribute, then it becomes a performance engineer. When you're doing performance engineer job, at certain point, you're looking at, okay, if I was running a car, what you do? So this is kind of like a continuation of that. My previous job as an engineering director, I was focused on, of course, being an engineering director, but certain things outside of my limit, or there was a certain, let's say, things that is put in place or not in place, are not working very well, then you always think, okay, if I was doing it, how do I do it? You know, how do I communicate to make it better? So when Jean asked me if I was interested in doing it, then of course I was interested because there's plenty of idea. I thought, because I believed this team always had very good people, very, very good people. You know, considering the size of the team, we are very, very small team, but I could see the quality in the people. So I thought, okay, it's a matter of putting it together, you know, communicate very well, give them clear direction, let them work, you know, provide them with the environment they can flourish. I didn't know how much better I could do, but all I was sure was I could definitely better than what we did in 23. So that much I was sure. Then, of course, to start off with, I was focused on really the technical side, because biggest criticism we had in 23 or years before that is the Haas F1 team cannot develop the car. They may start the season okay, but they really cannot make the upgrade work, which is fundamentally incorrect. You know, then I really believed we got people to do it. It's just that they weren't communicating very well. They weren't given the right direction. So I focused on that side. And then I think last year we proved that we can develop the car. And this year we proved it again. So my initial focus for sure is putting the right people in the right place in a technical department, create a structure that really promote communication, teamwork. And then I send a clear message about that. We really got to work as a team. Like you just mentioned, we cannot have blame culture. We are the smallest team by far. If we are blaming each other, we got no chance against the bigger teams. For us to have any chance of competing, we got to stick together. We got to support each other. And then having this positive working environment. So that's what we focused on. Then once the technical department is working to a certain degree, I thought, okay, how can we make this team better? You know, how can we make even faster car? Then it's about resource. Then that resource meaning, you know, hardware, more people, better software, better toolset. That means revenue. So I'm more focused on the commercial side at the moment. But basically, I'm just focused on how can we go to the next step. So whatever is holding us up, that would be my focus. And then, like I said, I'm not doing it on my own. I have a very good people underneath me, with me. So really listening to them and understand, okay, before your constraint was this, you weren't given the freedom to do certain things, but now our target is this. In order for you to hit this target, what do you need? Then that's my job as a team principal to provide that.
It's never easy to follow a big personality in a role. Whether the personality is doing a good job or a bad job, forget about that for a second. Just a huge character, as you did with following Gunter Steiner, who was kind of the, I guess he was the founder team principal of this team, because yeah. I remember him when he was building the whole setup.
Sure.
You worked with him,
yeah.
Obviously. But a big part of coming in here as the leader was, how do I communicate with people, knowing that obviously the guy before me was this big character? How did you approach that?
Honestly, I really focused on myself, in the sense that, you know, why did Jean put me in this position? You know, if Jean wanted another big character, he wouldn't have chosen me. The reason Jean chose me was because he knew that I was here from day one. So that means I know the people, I know the system, I know the team very, very well. So his hope was that because I know the team, I knew exactly where to, let's say, improve straight away. That means then we can get a quick return. So I was really focused on my strengths, the advantages I had, which is the very fact that I've been here from day one. I knew people exactly where the issues were, exactly where the strengths lie. So really to try to people's strengths. So put the right people, right person in the right place. And then just a minor adjustment in the structure. But that minor adjustment can have a big influence. You know, and then that's, I'm talking about mainly in terms of communication. You know, technical capability of people, I was totally confident. I know that we have guys with lots of talent, but just to get people to work together, having a closed loop communication flow so that whatever, let's say, we find on the truck side or driver says, that's unfiltered, going back into the technical office, technical director, head of aero, so that we can develop the car correctly. So it's really more focusing on not thinking about how am I going to replace my predecessor. No, it's like looking at what's in front of me. Okay, what's this organization need? What's my strengths? What's people's strengths? How are we going to play to the people's strengths?
So for people that look at Haas from the outside, people that follow Formula One, particularly I'm thinking now of the new fans to the sport,
you know,
that have come in the last 5 years with all the great work that Liberty Media have done with Drive Survive, social media, and all the other things. They look at the teams and they're trying to figure out who they should support.
Yes.
And when they look at Haas, tell them, give me your 30-second pitch as to why a new fan should support Haas. What does Haas stand for?
Haas stands for, I think, we are a race team. We are not corporate. We are the smallest team. We are pure race team. We don't have that much bureaucracy. We don't have that much corporate inertia. We here exist just to produce the sporting performance. So everything is really simplified, purified for that. And then we got to have that efficiency and focus to produce result with a team of our size. So I think that, and then also if you look at our owner, Mr. Haas, he's the single private owner of a F1 team. And he's an entrepreneur. You know, he was a machinist. He's a self-made billionaire. So, and then he came into Formula One 10 years ago when Formula One was nothing like this, right? And he loves motorsports. He's an American private entrepreneur. So if you look at American population, I'm sure entrepreneurship is a big part in American culture. And also we started as a, let's say, underdog. Now I want to come away from that now. You know, you cannot forever be underdog, right? We are a challenger for sure, but not underdog anymore. So again, I think lots of people can resonate Haas as a privateer, entrepreneurship, pure race team who is punching above their weight.
I love that. That's really good. And you are punching above your weight. I mean, can we just talk about a couple of recent races which really caught the eye? Mexico,
sure.
Let's start with that. Particularly the performance by Ollie Bearman.
Yeah.
He was running for about 12 laps in a podium position. He delivered the equal best result for Haas in Formula One,
yeah,
of fourth place at the end. I want to get your overview of the race, but first, I just want to focus on one particular detail, which I imagine as the leader of the team must have really made you very happy, which is that when you were fighting for that podium,
yeah,
and you're up against Mercedes or whatever, and your mechanics chose that moment to perform their fastest pit stop for 4 years, not just this season. Fastest pit stop for 4 years. It showed that everybody so badly wanted the result. But what it says to me as well is understanding the high performance mindset. Every single one of those people delivered under pressure.
Honestly, you mentioning that now still gives me a goosebump. I'm reliving the moment. You know, for sure that was I was really really proud, because you cannot get higher pressure than that. You know, because we all practice in our equipment. Is not as good as Mercedes. I have to accept that, you know. So our guys are up against it, but our mindset is like human performance, high performing organization, and we prepare for moments like that. But when it actually happens, you know, you are racing for the team's best ever result, and then we come in at the same time as George Russell of Mercedes, multiple championship winning team, giant of a Formula One team, and then I couldn't even turn around to see the pit stop. I just wanted to hear it. So I was facing ahead, i.e. the pit lane, so I'm having my car at the back. I was hoping the sound would just go zzz, zzz, like a proper synchronized pit stop, and it went. Then when I looked at the time, Mercedes 3.2 second, Haas 2.3 second. Wow, I'm so proud of the guys. You know, it's very, very difficult to perform that level of a pit stop under such a huge pressure, but they just did it. So that race, everything. It's just a huge team effort. Strategy guys, tire guys, race engineer, communication, support from here, back in Bambari, support from Italy office, pit crew, driver, of course. So it just everything came together on that Sunday, you know, to represent who we are. So that's our new benchmark now.
You're listening to the James Allen and F1 podcast, part of the Autosport Podcast Network. For the latest from our reporters at the racetrack during F1 weekends, head to the Autosport F1 channel.
We'll come back to talk about Ollie Bearman's performance in a moment, but just generally speaking, it's not easy in modern Formula One. And particularly, it seems to me, in 2025, the end of this rule set and just the level of the competition, how close everyone is, it's not easy to put together a complete weekend. You know, maybe there are 10 things you need to get right. And if you get 8 or 9 of them right, you know, you are having an amazing day, aren't you? But why is it so hard to do that this
season? Tell me about it. It's, we've been living that, obviously, every single race weekend. And then, you know, Olivier, we're talking about Olivier, man. He's got bags of talent. His speed is no doubt. He's ultra quick. But if you make a mistake in one part of the weekend, that could be your chance gone. Because especially fighting where we are in midfield, within a tenth of a second, there's so many drivers. So every single qualifying session, it's not, there's not much difference between out in Q1 being P18 or P19 or going to Q3 and be P6. There's not that much difference. So everything has to be perfect. And then from get-go in FP1, there's not a session you can waste. There's not a run you can waste. Even talking more, there's not a lap you can waste. Every single lap, every single time you go out, you need to be learning, you need to be making improvements. Then if you have a, let's say, accident in a critical moment, that's game over. I mean, Baku sadly was a great example. We know how quick Ollie Bearman is in Azerbaijan street circuit, but in the qualifying Q2 round one, he was, again, I wouldn't even say it's overdriving. But then it was windy, very, very windy, gusty on that day. But he knew that from FP3. So, but then Q2 round one, when you shouldn't be completely on the edge, he was a bit too close to the edge, and he was very unlucky to have a huge amount of tailwind. Then he crashed, he touched the wall. That was game over. Then that was your chance of scoring points over on Sunday. But if the field wasn't so tight, you can recover from that. But field is so tight. So if you have that kind of incidents in Q2, it's game over. So it is very difficult. It is very, very tough. But I think it's great for the sport. You know, when I really cannot remember the time in Formula One in a long lap, like, I don't know, lap or like 1 minute, 15 seconds, there's cars, 6 or 7 cars within tenths of a second. It's amazing, I think.
Yeah, no, it is. It's certainly as competitive as I've ever seen it. Can we talk a bit about the development of Bearman? Because everybody will remember that he came to prominence when he was substituted at the last minute in Saudi Arabia last year for Ferrari, because Carlos Sainz had appendicitis, I think it was. And without really any practice, he got in the car, did a super job in qualifying, and finished 7th, I think, which is a very on a circuit like Jeddah, which is high speed street circuit, blind bends, opportunities for a rookie to drop it everywhere. And that really got him on everyone's radar. Ferrari obviously believed in him. You gave him a run, I think, in Baku, a substitute for Magnussen. Yeah, exactly. And again, he performed incredibly well. I think he beat
Nico.
Nico, exactly.
Yes.
So that was enough, I guess, to convince you that you should give the guy a chance. But it's, How good is he, and how high do you think his ceiling is?
He's incredibly talented. He's one of the fastest drivers I've ever seen. So ceiling, I haven't seen it. So it's really more matter of harnessing that talent, nurturing that talent. You know, you talk about that Saudi last year, but we've been working with Ollie since the Mexico FP1 2 years ago. Then that Mexico FP1 was a huge, huge shock to me. Impressive, absolutely impressive. He was 18. He really understood what team needed for that FP1 session. And then the rate he learned throughout that session was incredible. And the maturity he had, the approach he had. Of course, speed impressed me, but more the approach and maturity that really impressed me, and also gave me the idea that, okay, on top of this speed, he's already got the speed, but with this maturity and the understanding, the openness, how quickly he runs, his potential is way, way, way beyond that. So to me, what he did in Saudi for Ferrari, even though it was such a difficult situation, that wasn't a surprise. But again, he is everything on a knife edge. If you look at Saudi qualifying, between being hero to zero, it's not much difference. I mean, he touched the wall a few times, I think, if I remember correctly. But that one, where he was on the right side of the margin, if you like. It's very, very easy to go on the wrong side of the margin, but he was on the right side, and he performed. He scored a P7 for Ferrari in a Saudi, like you say, high-speed street circuit, really unforgiving to any mistakes you have. And then driving for Ferrari with minimum notice, you cannot get higher pressure than that. So he's definitely able to cope with the pressure, and he's got such a speed. I mean, demonstrated again last year in Brazil, where I told him 6 o'clock in the morning on Friday, you're driving a car. You know, that's 5 hours before FP1 session, and then that was sprint weekend. And he got in the car without any preparation, no simulator work, no engineering session, because I wasn't expecting that to happen. Just Kevin wasn't very well at all. So he jumped in with 5 hours notice, zero preparation. I still remember FP1, lap one, watching it. I was like, wow, how can he do this on first push lap, right? So that's how talented he is. But like with any of those incredibly fast guys, the margin is so small, it's on a knife edge. So speed is not a question. We just got to work with him to basically build up through the weekend, nurture that talent to peak at the right moment. That's what we've been working on. I'm so happy to say Singapore, he's done that. And then Austin, apart from a couple of incidents in the race, he's done that. Mexico, perfect weekend. Brazil, he had a bit of blip in SQ2. But other than that, he recovered very, very well. Qualifying performance, race performance, Portres.
I guess he carried quite a lot of confidence into the Brazil weekend, coming off that incredible performance in Mexico. And confidence can't be underestimated in Formula One, can it?
Totally agree. But of course, confidence is a double-edged sword as well. You know, you cannot be complacent, you cannot be arrogant. And if you're a little bit overconfident in FP2, okay, Brazil was sprint weekend, let's say a little bit overconfident in FP1, that could ruin your weekend as well, right? And then SQ2, like I said, he had a bit of blip. That's nothing to do with overconfident. He just pushed certain corner a bit too much and then lost 2.5 tenths. Then in this tight midfield, that's game over, right? But the way he understood that, thought about it, and then reset himself for Saturday morning, had a brilliant sprint, then performing the way that he did on Saturday afternoon in Quali, that shows, like I said, how quickly he runs, how quickly he can correct his mistakes to perform at that level. And then Sunday race, like Mexico, absolutely faultless. He knew exactly what we needed to do. We are all on the same page, but delivery of it was amazing.
The other thing that I think is really helpful to those of us who watch it really closely is you've got a really good benchmark driver in the other car. I mean, you cleared out the driver lineup to put two completely new drivers in this year. And Esteban Ocon has obviously been around for quite a few years. He's a race winner. He's a known quantity. He's a very, very good benchmark. So for you to measure not only Ollie's development, but obviously Esteban's, whether he's got more in him as well, whether he's got more room to grow, and also how fast your car is.
Yeah, totally. I mean, Esteban, the reason we signed Esteban is, you know, we knew we were going to sign Oli because he's just such an exciting young talent. I needed a benchmark, like you say. Esteban's proven race winner, podium finisher, non-quantity. He's very fast in the qualifying. I think in the previous to this year, he's been beaten all the teammates, including Fernando Alonso, across the course of the season. So he's a very, very fast driver. But this shows how quick Oli is in qualifying. In the race, Esteban is very, very good. You know, you saw on Sunday coming back from a pit lane start how quickly he rode through the came through the field. So, but in the qualifying trim, Oli is very, very fast. Again, if we talk about Brazil last year, when he jumped in the car alongside Nico Hülkenberg, Nico last year was clearly a benchmark for us in qualifying. You know, again, Kevin is a very fast driver in qualifying, but Nico qualifying had an edge on Kevin on most of the circuit. And then Brazil, I can't remember exactly the lap time difference. I think he put something close to 3 tenths to Nico in Brazil, just jumping in. And then I was remember talking with Nico after the qualifying. He's a very, very, you know, great guy. He's a great guy. He doesn't hide behind anything. So he just said to me, I'm just confused because my lap was good. I felt that was the limit of the car. But if I look at all his data, he doesn't feel that limit and he's carrying this much entry speed. He just said, I can't, you know? So again, that goes to show the amount of natural talent Oli has. So I know he's very, very quick. So in terms of qualifying, it's more of a challenge for Esteban to match Oli. But in the race, I think they are both equal.
Well, we'll see as the years go on then, because generally rookies get better and better at racing, obviously, as they gain more and more experience. You find yourself then, AO, now with 3 races to go in a battle with Aston Martin, no less, for seventh in the Constructors' Championship. You might have aspirations even higher than that, but to be punching against a team which has got so much money and so much resources and a two-time world champion in one of the cars, that's not a bad place to be with three races to go. And I imagine you're pretty motivated.
Ah, absolutely. We are already pumped up with the result we have and the car we have and then drivers performing. You know, our start of the target was P6. You know, I knew it was a very, very ambitious target because we just missed out on P6 last year and we finished P7. And for this year, final year of the stable regulation, I had to put a very ambitious target to go one place better than last year. But we know that everybody would improve this year. So even to finish in the same place, which is P7, you know, currently we are P8, but 2 points to P7, to finish in the same place, our team had to be a lot better than last year. So to put an objective or target to say, guys, we need to go one step better, that's very ambitious. But like you said, at the moment we have 12 points off P6. So it's absolutely doable with three rounds to go. But for me, it's not much point actually counting the points gap. All we can do is focus on ourselves, taking each event at a time, then do the best job possible from lap one of FP1. So that's what we focused on. But with the car we got, with the drivers we got, if we execute everything, if we get everything out of it, of course, the result is sometimes out of your hands. You know, how well Racing Bull does, how well Aston Martin, that it's out of our hands. But if we do everything possible, get everything out of it, I believe a P6 is not out of reach.
Wow, that gives us something to enjoy and to watch for in the final rounds. Just you've been very generous with your time, Ayo. I just want to talk to you a little bit about next year.
Yeah.
Because we see all these stories and the quotes in the press about next year's cars, and it's going to be a bit like a sort of unbelievably complicated PlayStation game for the drivers. They're constantly going to be adjusting things and everything else. But put it in some simple, if you don't mind, put it in simple language for the listeners. You know, how will F1 2026 differ for the drivers, first of all, and then maybe we can come on and talk about how it'll look different for people on the outside watching.
For drivers, the biggest difference is how to optimize the energy recovery and the energy release, because we are going to be very, very much more limited by amount of energy you recover. So if you don't recover very well and you waste a little bit in a place that you don't need or you shouldn't do, then that's going to really be a huge disadvantage in a long straight. If you look at circuit like a Baku street course in Azerbaijan, in that castle section, low speed section, you got to be so careful to harness as much energy as possible, harvest as much energy as possible, and not to waste any energy. Because if you wasted energy there, where you don't need straight line speed, you're going to pay for it on the very, very long main straight. So drivers has to be very, very careful and educated. So things like simulator session, understanding what's required from engineering point of view for drivers to execute, that's going to be a whole another level.
That's really interesting. And for the fans, for people on the outside, what will they see?
It's difficult to predict, but I think, again, you know, before seeing all the PU manufacturers, what their solution is going to be, how their solution is going to be different, you know, who's got more energy available for the straight, etc. Until we see the difference, we don't know. But I think, like any other year with brand new regulation, this is the biggest change, right? Because we're not just changing power unit or chassis regulation, we're changing both. So PU difference, I'm sure there will be, you know, at least to start off, is on the aerodynamic solution, because it's a huge regulation change as well, from ground effect to the flat bottom car, essentially with that straight line mode. Again, who's got it right to start off is, I think start of the season, you will see a big difference. But I think what will be exciting for us and for the fans is how quickly people will develop and then learn from each other. I mean, if you look at 2022, again, this first year of this ground effect car regulation, there was a big difference, right? 4 years on, that's the tightest championship you say ever. So I think Formula One, what I think we can be proud of is our quality, how quickly people run and develop. That's not something repeated outside of F1. I think that's something like a Formula One as a community can be really proud of and showcase to the world. So honestly, it's a bit difficult for me to predict exactly how it's going to look like at race one, race two, race three, but the landscape will change very quickly because everybody will learn so quickly.
That's really interesting. And I guess one of the real dominant narratives of 2025 has been that everybody's going to stop developing their car because they need to put their effort on next year. And some people have gone really early on Ferrari, look for example. Other people have left a bit of a margin to keep on pushing a little bit. So Mercedes, for example, has still improved their car a little bit. You made some modifications quite late on in the season, which have really helped you recently. But just let us understand from your point of view, from the Haas team point of view, what was your approach to this? Did you put all of your eggs in the 2026 basket, or did you just have a couple of updates you wanted to have? How did you approach it? And are you happy you've taken the right decision?
The very last question, am I happy? Yes, I am. But so the approach we had at the beginning of the season was simplistic. We had three different directions to go. One, if we go to race one in a very, very optimistic scenario where our car was incredibly competitive, we'd have stopped 25 development at that point and then put everything for 26. I'm talking very extreme case here.
Yeah.
But in a completely opposite case, you know, going to the race one, if your car's so totally uncompetitive, you cannot just leave your car there and finish this year P10 because we cannot make the budget work for 26. So then that means you have to sacrifice 26 to get a sporting result for 25. But our baseline was somewhere in the middle. You know, we expected our car to be somewhere around P7, P8, somewhere around there to start of the season. If that's the case, we had a baseline development plan, gradually shifting our focus towards 26. At certain point, 25 becomes 25%. At some point, 25 becomes zero, right? Then, of course, Melbourne, we had a disaster. So at that point, we are fully focused on solving that issue for 25 car. But that wasn't different from the baseline. Then around basically before Silverstone time, that's the point where, okay, should we diverge from baseline plan or not? Then our car wasn't great, but it wasn't a disaster. You know, if we get everything right, we can score points in every race. So we didn't diverge from baseline plan. Then Silverstone upgrade was always planned. That was potentially a last upgrade. But at that point, we left, I'd say, let's say 10% of resource on 25 car and 90% already. As soon as we defined Silverstone, 90% went on to 26. So I was happy with that. And with that 10% resource, there was no guarantee that we are going to put any more upgrade. But that small team did a very, very good job learning from what we've done in Silverstone, understanding what worked, then came up with the package for Austin. Then we looked at it, how much it's going to cost. Then we decided, okay, that could be the difference in one championship position, which is completely justifiable. So we decided to press green button for that. Then so far, if we look at our performance, Austin, Mexico, Brazil, I think it was the right decision. But of course, you know, if you compare the teams where they last time they put 25 car was in January, you know, they've been doing all 26 throughout the year. Of course, we're going to be behind compared to those guys. But realistically, if we look at our team in terms of how we are set up, if we don't have a certain sporting result, we cannot make 26 work. So that was the strategic decision.
I love that. That is such F1 thinking from start to finish. It's just that just really sums up the F1 mentality, I think. And guess what? You got the payback, right? I mean, you got, like we just said, you got the payback in Mexico, you got the payback in Brazil. And not only that, but I imagine that sense of togetherness that you got as a team from what you achieved in Mexico, which was only achievable because you put the effort in to do that upgrade in Austin, that what that will do for you as a team and togetherness will carry you for years.
Thank you for mentioning that. That's exactly our aim. That's what I think as well. And also the confidence that brings to people. If you talk about togetherness, you know, we talked about disaster in Melbourne. Melbourne, we weren't expecting that performance. But as soon as we sent the car out in FP1, looking at going through high-speed corners, initially I thought we had a traffic or something. You know, we're just taking it easy. Then realized, no, that's the limit of the car. Then that was a huge surprise for us. That was honestly the moment where we are like, oh my God, what have we done? But what was amazing was the reaction, every single reaction after that. The senior guys didn't sleep much in Melbourne because we realized, okay, the seriousness of problem, we got to accept it. One, we accept it. Two, we got together and they formulated what we're going to do about it, short term, medium term, and long term. Short term meaning race 3 in Suzuka. Okay, Shanghai was the next back-to-back. We accepted we can't do anything. So we're at the mercy of the truck. By going to Suzuka without doing anything with a high-speed sector one, we're going to be last by far, which is not acceptable. So it's a short time we got to do something in Suzuka. Then take whatever the learning we have from Suzuka, we put another update, as in not a performance update to rectify that issue in Imola. So the guys worked really well together. There was no blame at all. We just all accepted, right, guys, we got the issue. How are we going to look at it? How are we going to solve it? How are we going to tackle it? Everybody, not just the ARN designer guys, the procurement guys, everybody worked so hard to bring that upgrade to Suzuka. And then that worked. That went in the right direction. So that gave us confidence to do in the same direction to solve the problem completely at Imola, which we did. And then that meant Silverstone upgrade. It was the first pure performance upgrade, which put us our competitiveness up completely. Then that followed on to Austin. So for me, that process, the fact that we can, it's not just we can do it, we proved we can do it. So for me, next year, 26 start can be anything. But with that confidence, with that togetherness you talked about, I think we are ready for anything. You know, if we can deal with that Melbourne disaster in the way that we did, we didn't disintegrate. We actually came together, brought us stronger, then proved we can solve it in that short space of time. And then making the Silverstone Austin upgrade work means that 26, imagine, it could be a disaster to start off with. It could be P10, P11, nowhere, right? But with that confidence and togetherness, we know that if we work together, we support each other, we can solve anything. So that carries on as a foundation of the team, I think.
Well, that's a great place for us to finish. Thank you so much for your time. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Well, Dan, I mean, straight off the top, the first thing you've got to say is he's a very likable character, isn't he, AO?
He is incredibly engaging, isn't he? I mean, I love the fact he sort of balances this sort of, you know, quite engineering, sort of, you know, very sort of logical thinking, but he comes across as very warm as well, doesn't he? And very, you know, very sort of interested in the well-being and, you know, how his staff are getting on as well. And I think that's really nice to hear.
I think this is one of my favourite of all the interviews I've done actually over the last 18 months of doing this podcast for many reasons. But I think really it's just because that whole story about the pit stop in Mexico, that the team executed this flawless stop just when they absolutely needed to, the fastest stop that Haas have done for 4 years of Formula One competition. That is really the essence of what Formula One is all about, isn't it? Just getting everybody pointing in the same direction, that high performance mindset. And you can understand why he was getting goosebumps just reliving the moment, can't you? It's a fantastic story there.
It is. And I think it's particularly amazing because, you know, clearly in any high stress situation, that's when you expect something to go wrong. You know, so it's almost, you know, whenever the you need that particularly clean pit stop in a race, you're always sort of slightly waiting for somebody to get the jitters. And you know, it only takes one person out of the whole crew to make a very, very small mistake, and suddenly you don't get that, you know, 2 second pit stop. It's a, you know, 3 or 4 second one, and that's a bit of a problem. So when it all comes together like that, that's an extraordinary thing. And I can completely see why you'd say that. You know, if there's a feeling in the team that they're getting that momentum together, and then you get something like that, it's a really kind of visceral demonstration of the team pulling together, isn't it? It must be a wonderful thing in his position.
And I guess it really galvanizes everybody. I mean, you know, that's not a one-off, is it? When everybody gets that feeling, that sense of togetherness that comes from having pulled something like that off, the driver did his part, the strategist did their part, and then the team did their part. That sort of energy, that positive vibe, can that carry you for a few weeks? Could that potentially carry them to the end of the season?
I think it can. I mean, I think, you know, what he was mentioning about the, you know, the upgrades and the, you know, pit stop and any other opportunities they've had to sort of show that they're competing. You know, obviously Ollie Bearman having some great results in there as well. I think that all points towards this sense of momentum, this sense of feeling that they can actually compete, where, you know, they could have been feeling quite bruised after the beginning of the season. And it really does, I think, it sort of instills a sense of belief in the whole team where they start to believe, well, maybe we can actually, you know, we should be holding our head up high, and we should be sort of competing for that sixth place. So, yeah, I do think it absolutely carries them through. I mean, listening to that interview, you'd come away thinking, I mean, you know, good luck to anyone else competing with them at the moment, because they're really on fire, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. It's great. So I'd love your commentary as a very experienced technical leader who's made a lot of very important decisions throughout your career to develop this or not that, where to put your resources and everything else. I'd love your commentary on what AO was saying about taking the decision where a lot of teams this year decided to park development of the car and just focus on 2026. partly because they couldn't afford to finish last. So there was a kind of a existential kind of dynamic to them, to it for them. But they kind of made some change. And I guess the competitive in the last few races, that is, it's really paying off, that decision to develop. But talk us through that process and how knife-edge those decisions are at a time like that.
Yeah, but you really picked up on that at the time, didn't you? I think that's it's a very interesting insight into a sort of engineering way of looking at it. It is a very Formula One mindset, as you said at the time. It's you have to think it through in an incredibly logical way, and it's amazing how these sort of external factors play into decisions like that. You know, obviously it's not easy to decide when to stop development of a car, because you're essentially having to get your crystal ball out a little bit and, you know, see how you're going to end the season. And quite often the decision that you're making is going to be made around sort of, you know, May time, June time, something like that, in the year preceding a new car, or in particular for new regulations. So that's the kind of time you'd be thinking about. And you could project into the future and say, well, you know, we're this position in the championship now, so let's hope that we carry on with that. We think our car is reasonably competitive. But then something happens like exactly what Haas have done, and they come along with an upgrade that suddenly makes them a lot more competitive, and your own calculations go out the window. What's made it even harder this year is that, you know, people have realized, because they've not been able to develop the car until, you know, aerodynamically until January of this year. So they've only had a kind of slightly compressed time for a very big rule change. They then got to the situation where some people have probably rolled the dice. I think we believe the McLaren may have done this, by really starting their development very early and stopping the development on this year's car quite early as well. So you're really focusing as much resource on 26 as you can, which is obviously great for next year, but it is a roll of the dice. It's really risky. So unless you believe that your car is significantly faster than everybody else's, or certainly the people you're competing against, that's a big risk. So, but it's very interesting to hear what he said about, you know, the kind of financial aspects of it. Then they're one of the only teams that I think has to really think about that. You know, I think a lot of people, it is very disappointing if you lose positions in the championship, because it's, you know, millions of dollars, and who wants to lose millions of dollars? But it probably isn't an existential problem. For most people, if they lose a position or two, whereas for them, it really is a problem. Fascinating that there's so many sort of other aspects to what they're having to think about when they sort of decided to put the sort of latest effort into this year's car.
What's your analysis of the performance of Ollie Bearman? I mean, we knew that he was obviously talented, he's quick, he had plenty of nerve, because he jumped in that super sub appearance for Ferrari in Saudi Arabia last year. But what's your analysis of the performances he's putting on the table now? And I asked Ayo the question, how high do you think his ceiling is, which he didn't answer, but what's your take on it?
He's clearly had some very impressive results, and there's a period of time when, you know, when maybe they were sort of lingering towards the back end of the grid, and I think the temptation is to, you know, from the outside, is to look at that and think, oh well, maybe he's not that good, but I think it's important to realize that, you know, cars are maybe not competing at the highest part of the grid for a variety of reasons. It can be that, you know, they're a reasonably nice car to drive, but they just don't have an awful lot of outright performance, maybe not so much downforce, or that they could have, you know, a reasonable amount of downforce, but actually be very, very, very tricky to drive. And it's sometimes difficult to know quite why that's a problem. So we tend to look at people's teammates to see where they are. And obviously he's up against Esteban, who's, you know, incredibly experienced. But it's not really great. Is it what you want to see is, okay, well, let's put them in a really competitive machine and see what they can do. And I think that's what's impressed me the most. As the car's got more competitive, clearly, he's been able to just sort of jump straight onto that and really get the results in, which is, yeah, incredibly impressive. And that's the kind of thing you want to see in the driver, really, where they get this sniff of good performance. They, you know, it's almost like they go into another gear and they start delivering, you know, extraordinary lap times in races. And I think his racecraft will just improve as everybody does. But really, he seems to have a pretty old head on his shoulders anyway. So, yeah, he's going to be a force, definitely.
He is. Now, listen, Dan, I know you're well up on the 2026 regulations and how it's all going to be. Obviously, there's a lot of question marks at the moment for a lot of people. AO was explaining in the interview there that from the driver's point of view, that energy management piece is going to be really important. But then there's some big aerodynamic changes too in terms of the floor of the car, the way the cars are going to behave. He was saying that in 2022, you know, the field got spread out again with the new rules coming in. Red Bull obviously were well ahead. That meant Max Verstappen could win his world championships, etc. But 4 years on, you know, we've got the closest grid perhaps ever in Formula One. So do you expect the same thing to happen with this next rule set coming in next year, that maybe there might be a few gaps, but that actually because these teams are so good now and so sophisticated that very quickly, even if that is the case, very quickly, we'll get back to a really competitive field again within a year or two?
Yes, I do. I think it will start off as with a bigger split between the teams. I think that's fairly inevitable when you get a new rule set. This one that we've got coming for next year, it obviously includes the power unit changes as well. So there's a lot of things that are changing at the same time aerodynamically in the power unit. The cars are getting smaller, they're narrower and shorter. And I think there will inevitably be a lot of conversation about the power unit, the way that energy is deployed, what the drivers have to do. That's something that we'll really start to understand at the beginning of the season. And that will be probably the most talked about aspect of it. But, you know, it's not just that that determines your competitiveness, and also a huge aerodynamic regulations upheaval means that some people will just have done a better job than others. And it's really about trying to spot the opportunities as much as anything. I mean, we've seen this regulation set and also the one that led up to 22 are quite different from what Formula One saw before in terms of, you know, there is a reasonable amount of prescription. You know, the FIA have done certain things to ensure that, you know, cars produce a wake, which means that it's relatively easy for one to follow another. And that means to do that, they've had to try to sort of define the way the cars look to a greater extent than maybe they did before. The thing that will define the teams or make them set them apart was really finding those sort of loopholes, if you like, or the tricks that will allow them to get that extra downforce. But inevitably, once they've been seen by other people, then obviously people will jump on that and they'll start to add that to their own cars. And it's hard to hide things like that. You'd love to. If you get something that's particularly good and your competitors didn't see it, you do everything you can to hide it. But these days it's very, very tricky. So I do expect, you know, both on the power unit side and aerodynamically, I do think that we'll see convergence. But it'll be interesting to see how long it takes.
What's the limit, do you think, of what a team like Haas can achieve in Formula One? What do you think is the highest that they can aspire to?
I think we were talking about the beginning of next season. I mean, that for a team like that, it is a golden opportunity, really, because it's the kind of thing where you can compete at a time when other teams maybe are struggling a little bit. We saw that going into this last regulation set. You know, it took the likes of, you know, Mercedes and even McLaren. I mean, it took them a while to get on top of it. Once they did, obviously, then became a lot more competitive. But that does present a smaller team, you know, a big opportunity. Maybe not to win races, but maybe to, you know, score an awful lot of points. And while everybody else is sort of catching up with, you know, what is the kind of inverted commas right way of doing things. So I do think that gives them a chance. I think longer term, it is harder. And I think that's one of the reasons that, you know, Formula One has decided to have reasonably regular changes of the sort of regulation set or the way the cars are built, is to do exactly that, is to give people an opportunity to shake up that competitive order. And that's really where I think, you know, teams that are in that position, it's inevitably just much harder as time goes on and the developments get smaller and smaller, the gains are smaller and smaller. That does bias, unfortunately, the teams that just have more resource, more experience, you know, better capabilities. I think that's just inevitable, really.
And a final thought, Dan, on Las Vegas Grand Prix this weekend, nature of the circuit, cold weather, etc. What do you think we can expect? Who's going to work for and who's it not going to work for?
Well, I know that, you know, there's been talk about whether McLaren will sort of suit or the, you know, the McLaren car will suit a track like that. We've seen some very interesting races there in the past, certainly. And it's a very odd circuit, very different from a lot of the other ones. I think if we look to Baku as something that is relatively similar in the long straight and so on, that's maybe give us some indication. But it'll be very interesting to see. I mean, Ferrari obviously looking for a good result. I think they would desperately like to get that win this season if they can. So I think they're definitely one to watch for, because I think they'll be throwing everything they can at it. Certainly been looking on with interest. It's going to be an incredible run into the end of the season, isn't it?
It certainly is. It certainly is. Okay, well, listen, thank you so much for your time, Dan. That will do us. My thanks to Ayo Komatsu and to Dan Fellows. Where can the listeners find your latest writings then, Dan?
I've been writing on Substack, and I've also got a column on website called Race Tech, which is Race TEQ.
Perfect. Excellent. Well, make sure you go and check that out. And you can read all of the latest F1 news and insights from this weekend's Las Vegas Grand Prix on the Autosport and Motorsport channels. Remember to send in your comments and questions to @JamesAllen on F1 on X. My thanks to Andrea and to Ben on production. And thanks to you all for listening. Please click to follow or subscribe, leave us a review, and tell all your F1 mad friends about us. We'll be back with another podcast very soon.